I suspect the 45% drop is due to small number statistics. All right, so astrophysics from the stratosphere. I guess you know that I'm a balloonatic, so I'm going to talk about some of our balloon projects. Right. So my wife asked me, why are you so nervous about giving this talk? You're never nervous about talks. It's like, well, I know these people. Okay, that's how it goes. All right, so let's talk about, first about BLAST, which is an experiment that we've been working on since I sort of showed up here, and I've probably given a few G2000s on it, so people from astronomy are going, again? Yeah, well, okay. BLAST is a submillimeter telescope designed to look at star formation. And so I'll just give you a quick overview of what sort of the goals of the experiment are. This is the spectrum of the sky averaged over large angles. So it's kind of the cosmic backgrounds slide, wavelength down here. This is the cosmic microwave background, which is the light from the primordial plasma from the Big Bang. This is the cosmic optical background, in other words, the overall glow in the sky from stars and galaxies and such, but from stars. And this is the cosmic infrared background, which is what BLAST is trying to study. And what's that from? Well, given the wavelengths, it's from things that are a few tens of degrees. So what's a few tens of degrees? Well, not stars, but that's part of the story. Let's start here. So if you're an astronomer, you spend your life in front of this plot, or at least you spend your time studying for the quals in front of this plot. And if you're a physicist, you say, what? Okay. Temperature down here, and of course astronomers, because they're backwards, plot big numbers over on this side and small numbers on that side. So this is high temperatures and low temperatures. And this is luminosity, 10 to the 6th, 5th, 4th, 3rd, okay. Up here are really, really bright stars, O and B stars. They are a million times as bright, say, as the sun, which is one solar luminosity in the unit in which the sun is one. Then down here, the cooler stars are 10,000 times dimmer. And of course, they drop off the deep end here when they can't undergo fusion. All right, that's fine. Why do I care about this HR diagram? Because one of the things we're trying to understand is star formation. And if you want to understand star formation, you need to find out where stars are recently forming. And it's kind of hard to date just a random run-of-the-mill main sequence star. But it's easy to date a really, really bright O and B star, because if it exists, it means that it's really young, because they're a million times brighter, they burn a heck of a lot faster, and they disappear. So if you're going to find a place where there's O and B stars, or particularly O stars in particular, then you know that stars have formed there recently, right? Because they only last millions of years. All right, that's great. Excellent. Now, so if you want to understand star formation, one approach is to go find the O and B stars and count them, and then figure out how many stars are being formed in that area, which is great, except, unfortunately, stars form inside clouds of dust. So here's a really cool picture of the Milky Way taken by some amateur. I got off the web, asked him if I could show it. He said, sure. This guy actually traveled the world with his camera in the 90s, taking pictures of the sky and stitches together to make this. Ooh. Okay, it's the Milky Way. And if you've seen the Milky Way, of course, you've seen these dark dust lanes. And those dark dust lanes are lanes of dust blocking the starlight behind it. And inside those dust clouds is where star formation happens. And as you can see, it blocks the starlight, which makes searching for newly formed stars a challenge. Okay. Might be getting somewhere. And here's Andromeda. You can see the same story here, these dust lanes. So it turns out that dust is something around 10 Kelvin, 15 Kelvin average temperature, which means the black body peaks in the submillimeter. Now, if the clever observer will notice that I've labeled these backwards. That's 12 and that's 10. Okay, so nobody be a clever observer. Just let it go by. Here I have just two modified black bodies simulating what dust spectrum might look like. As one's at 12 Kelvin and one's at 10 Kelvin. And these are the three bands that we're going to observe with BLAST. And the idea is, if you can observe a dust cloud in these three bands, by looking at the ratios of the temperatures, of the brightnesses, the color, you can determine the temperature. So we're going to build a telescope that observes in the submillimeter near the peak of cold dust in three bands so that we can both see the emission from these clouds and we can determine the temperature of the dust. Now, something else to note, the dust is optically thin. That is to say, these grains are very small, micron scale, and we're looking at several hundred micron wavelengths, which means that the dust is emitting, what's the word, barely? So the optical depth is much less than one. You can actually see right through the galactic plane in this band because the optical depth is so small. So there's no problem seeing right through a cloud. Of course, the problem is dealing with projection. But if you have bright over densities inside the cloud, they'll show up. So if you can look right into a cloud of dust in the submillimeter and see sort of projection along the line of sight of all the mass and determine its temperature by looking at the three bands. So that's the game. We're going to build a telescope operating in the submillimeter at multiple frequencies around the peak of the black body. By looking at the ratios of the colors, we can measure the temperature of the dust. And because it's optically thin, we can peer right through the dust. There's no obscuration whatsoever. OK. Cool. Problem, of course, the atmosphere is only transparent at some wavelengths. So here we are. We're going to try and operate, I said, here around 250 microns. The atmospheric opacity is like 100%. That is to say, none of it gets down. So when we build BLAST and point the receiver across the street to try and focus it, in our shortest wavelength, we see, well, the atmosphere in front of us and not the targeting, not the focusing source. It's actually really opaque. So the object is to get out of the atmosphere onto a balloon or a satellite. Satellites are expensive. And it turns out they don't let grad students build billion-dollar satellites. So, but we're allowed to build balloons. I still think like a graduate student. We are allowed to build balloons. OK, stratospheric balloons. 1 or 2 million cubic meter balloons, 40 kilometer altitude, 3,000 kilogram payloads, flights up to 50 days long. In the case of BLAST, our cryostat only holds for about 12 days, so we kind of limit our flights to that. But these things can fly over Antarctica for weeks, up to months. OK. So, the instrument. So how do you detect submillimeter light? It's like if your aunt asks you if her microwave still works, what do? You take a piece of chicken, put it in the microwave, turn it on. Microwave gets hot. Or chicken gets hot, there's microwaves. Chicken doesn't get hot. No microwaves, right? I got this. So what we do here is we put pieces of chicken at the focus of the telescope and stick thermometers in them and measure the temperature. But instead of using chicken, we use spider webs, but same idea. There's 288 total bolometers. This is just one of the three frequency bands. 288 bolometers at these three wavelengths at the focus of a 2-meter telescope in a 50 millikelvin cryostat with a 2-week hold time. Here's the telescope hanging from a launch vehicle. We can control the telescope, but the design was to be able to control the telescope to about an arc minute. In reality, we do something substantially better than that, but we'll just say an arc minute because I can't. Well, no, it's actually quite a bit better than that. We were controlling the last flight to, we were getting, 10 arc seconds in azimuth and around 3 in elevation, which is pretty good. We can reconstruct the attitude to about 4 arc seconds, and it's a killer robot on a rope, and we program it what it's going to do, and it goes and does it. And then if we decide we don't like what it's doing, we can tell it to do something different. OK. So off to Antarctica. We actually flew first from Sweden in 2005. I'm not going to show you a slide on that flight because we were out of focus. But the cool thing is going to Antarctica is you get to fly in a C-17, which is like the height of luxury. We used to have to fly down in C-141s, which are terrible planes. But they're retired now, and C-17s are much nicer. Land on the ice. When we land there, this is McMurdo Sound, which later in the season becomes water. But at this time of the year, it's still frozen. It's something like 10 feet thick as ice. The airplane just landed right on the ice. It's kind of cool. McMurdo Station, sort of the height of luxury, because you live in a dorm and eat in a cafeteria, which is cool for a while and eventually gets tiring. And up on the top there is a cross in memory of Scott, who left from here on his way to die on the way back from the South Pole. Okay, it's the furthest south you can go by ship, which means that when we're down there in the austral summer, it's near freezing. Otherwise, you couldn't go there by ship, right? Cool. All right, 15 miles outside of town, 15 kilometers outside of town, on the ice shelf is a little base they've built for us. These two buildings are the high bays that we assemble everything in. Largest building in the world on skis. I guess there's not a lot of competition. Over here, what you can't see, is the pig barn, which is the old wooden barn we used to fly from, which, well, it sunk into the ice. And for years and years, every year they would have two cats running 24/7 plowing snow away from it so we could get into it. And eventually gave up, and now these are on skis, and they just pull them away when it starts not being where they want it to be. So that's a much better design. Height of luxury inside, you know, we got, you know, nicely heated floors and, you know, graduate students and everything else you could possibly want. Assembling blast, there's blast all assembled. There's a 2-meter primary there. These are just two CCD cameras which image the sky in optical just to look for stars, and then there's a software inside that says, ooh, I wonder what sort of star that is. Sort. Ah, now it knows where we're looking. So that way we can know exactly where we're looking during the flight. I guess a couple weeks ago, there was a talk on how you can drop a cat and have it land on its feet. Same principle for pointing the gondola. We have a reaction wheel here. So we want to turn to the right, you spin it to the left, and vice versa, which works fine until there's some net torque on the payload. So we also have a motor here that torques against the balloon called a pivot. But that's kind of slow, right? Because the balloon is, you have to torque through a ladder and a parachute up to the balloon, and it's kind of springy. So for short time scales, we torque against the reaction wheel, for long time scales against the balloon, and then we can point wherever we want, and everybody's happy. Hanging from launch vehicle before launch. Solar power. Okay, so here's the balloon ready to launch. It's only 0.5% full because we're going to go up to 39 kilometers. So it's going to expand by a factor 200. So the balloon itself actually comes to about here. But we're about to launch, release it. It goes up, and then the driver of the launch vehicle drives the launch vehicle underneath the balloon and lets it go, and it flies off. And then we spend the next 2 weeks doing this, which is stirring up plots, hoping that nothing goes horribly wrong. And occasionally it does, and then you panic, and then it doesn't again. All right, there was our flight in 2006. 12 days, all well. On the parachute on the way down. Now, right, so Antarctica is a place that adventurers like to go to Antarctica for adventures, right? And there is a particular group of adventurers who are down this year. And their adventure was to parasail across Antarctica. And they were going to, you know, skis and a parachute. And they're going to parasail across Antarctica. And they were down there on the far side of the continent from us. And they were complaining over their blog uplinked through Iridium phone that Antarctica is a terrible place because there's no wind. We didn't have that problem. So, yeah. So what's supposed to happen, you're supposed to land, and then the parachute's supposed to come off. Well, we landed and the parachute didn't come off. So it's dragging along here at around 12 knots. The C-130 circled for a while, pushing the red button and watching nothing happen. There we go. See, there's blast, traveling, leaving a furrow, and bits and pieces. So every day on the way to work, we'd pass Willie Field. And at Willie Field is a runway. And at Willie Field was this. And this is a re-engined DC-3 built in 1942. Uh-huh, yeah, cool. Like every day, ooh, I wish I could fly in that. Well, turns out that when your gondola gets dragged across Antarctica and they can't find it, they'll lend you a DC-3. So we headed off on the DC-3. So McMurdo Station is here. And we landed up here somewhere and dragged, you know, up here. So took off and headed up the Transantarctic Mountains. These are the Transantarctic Mountains. So what you're supposed to picture here is that you're in the Rockies just outside of Calgary, and it's been snowing for 1 million years and not thawing. So these are 7,000-foot mountains? Yeah, so cool. So what happens is the snow gradually flows between the mountains, down these glaciers, and down into the ice shelf. And at the top, where it's kind of doing this excitement stuff, you get these crevasses. Now, for scale, these are something like 15 feet across. And it's actually about a half a kilometer deep. But then snow is blown across to partially cover it. And you see them going both ways, this way and that way. So these are crevasse fields. Here's another picture of them. And sometimes you can see where they're, you can really barely see them. Oh, and here's Blast Parachute, and there's Blast. So there's Blast, dragged for 135 miles, and then fell through the, and got stuck in the crevasse. Oh, that's not cool. Okay, so we have a link to the payload. And during this flight, we had a link to the payload of around 6 kilobits per second to get our data down. And we accumulate data at around a megabit. Consequently, the data is on the payload, right? So 6 years in, millions of dollars, great flight, no disk drives. So which is why they lent us the DC-3, actually, to go and try and find the disk drives. The disk drives are in a tube around yay big around. Should have brought it with me. So I'm describing this to the station manager, and he says, what color is this tube? You see, there's really no air cooling in the stratosphere, because it's only 0.5% atmospheric pressure, and you don't get convection very well. So you want to radiatively cool, and it turns out that titanium dioxide is a great emitter at 10 microns, and is a great reflector in the visible, and is, well, it's white paint, right? So our disk drives were exact. The computers were a great temperature throughout the flight. And okay, so the cool thing is that this is the part of the telescope sticking out of the crevasse that would have held the pressure vessel. So we circled around for a while, taking pictures out the window and looking at them. Yeah, it's not there. Which is either good or bad, right? Bad because where's our data? Good because if it was there, well, that's about the worst place on the planet to put it. Because you can't really get there from here. So we're circling around. The pilot says, there's something on the drag path. Yeah, there's our hard disk. So here's the drag path. There's the crevasse field. It had dragged for 135 miles and fell off on that corner, about 2 miles from the crevasse field. And you can land an Twin Otter here, which they did, and came back with the data. So this is the areas of the sky we mapped. We mapped a couple deep regions off the galactic plane, trying to understand the source of the cosmic infrared background, and then some stuff in the galactic plane, trying to look at regions of nearby star formation. That's good, because now I don't have to be embarrassed showing up for work and people saying, have you read any papers lately? Right, so, yeah. So we have quite a, that was a paper from this flight. I've even read some of them. Don't say that, I didn't say that. Okay, so what do we get out of this? This is a signal-to-noise map of one of our regions. A signal-to-noise map is like a map of the sky, except divided by noise. We spent about half the time in this region and then half on the rest. The white spots are, well, bright spots in the sky, presumably galaxies. And if you see here, there's over 500 sources at greater than 5 sigma, and there's, of course, many, many, many more at fainter cuts. So this is what the sky looks like off the galactic plane in the submillimeter, lots of galaxies. That's cool. So take a look here. What you want to look at, you can look at this, or you can look at these two. This is a map. The same map at 250 microns, and there's a galaxy there, and there's not a galaxy there. And then let's go to the next frequency at 350, and you see this one getting dimmer, and that one's starting to poke up. And okay, right? So the idea is that you can actually try and determine the effect of temperature of these galaxies, because we have our three bands, like we talked about before. Now, if you assume that these galaxies are all around the same temperature, that's actually a tracer of their redshift. So you can say that this right here is a distant galaxy, or a cold one, but then it wouldn't be bright. It's probably a distant galaxy, and this other one is a nearby one. Cool. Okay, so lots of galaxies. What are we going to do with this? But this looks kind of like a mess, doesn't it? I think so. Okay, so here is a histogram of that of the deep region. So we're just taking, let's look at this region right here where we really integrated for a long, long time. So here's a histogram of it. This is the signal-to-noise ratio of each pixel and the number count. This dashed line was histogram of a noise-only map. And this is a histogram of the map we actually made, which says that, wow, that stuff that looks like noise in that previous map isn't noise. Everything in there is something on the sky. And it's got a bit of an extension here at a high scale. So what you might be tempted to do is say, oh, I think that all the bright things are galaxies, and then make a plot, which is the number as a function of signal to noise, cumulative net source counts. And if you were to do that, you would get these points here. And in real life, in the simulation, they're actually up there. In other words, you're going to get the answer completely wrong, because those bright things are not individual galaxies. They're a few galaxies. And they're brighter because they just happen to be a few of them close together. See, the problem is that bright galaxies are a lot more unlikely than dim galaxies. So at any given brightness, it's more likely that that bright spot on your map is two galaxies of half the brightness than it is that it's one of twice the brightness. So we can't just go doing number counts. So instead, what we try and do to understand what this is about is do statistics on the maps themselves. So you make the histograms, and you make a model, and you find the source density count that matches your map statistics. And from that, we can say, if the sky is made up of galaxies with this number count, this is the brightness and this is the numbers, if this number distribution here describes the brightness distribution of galaxies randomly on the sky, then that would be consistent with our map. So the claim then would be, we think that the cosmic inverted background and all these fluctuations is almost certainly due to galaxies. Maybe. Could be acne. So let's try something else. It turns out people have observed galaxies before at other wavelengths where they have a much better resolution. So this right here is each dot there is a galaxy from the Fidel 24 micron catalog from Spitzer. So this is a collection of galaxies detected with Fidel at 24 microns, and it's overlaid on top of our map. So what we do is we do a cross-correlation between this map and our map and say, if our map is made up of these galaxies, how bright would these galaxies have to be at our frequencies in a best fit sense? And from that, you can get the average submillimeter flux of a blast galaxy. Does that make sense? Kind of dull, right? This is astronomy, I'm sorry. We'll get to cool stuff. In any case, this spectrum here, which was of the cosmic infrared background of unknown source, if you take these amplitudes in the blast bands, you find that the blast observations are consistent with being the cosmic infrared background. So we can now pretty strongly say the cosmic infrared background is due to normal, boring galaxies, just like one might have expected. It would have been cool if it was something weird, but it's not. Okay, great. It turns out that, as we said, half the starlight in the universe is hidden behind dust, re-radiated in the submillimeter, and here it is. All right, another thing you can do is you can take those galaxies, you can break them up into redshift bins, you can do this correlation at different redshift stacks, and you see that the luminosity, and therefore the star formation rate, goes up as you go back in time, with a peak at something like a redshift of 1 or 2, and that's actually consistent with observations at other wavelengths. So we're able to see that, in fact, star formation was much greater at around half the age of the universe and has been dropping off radically since. Okay, nice. Now, Once again, BLAST also takes pretty pictures, not just, you know, sandpaper plots. Okay, so this is one of the regions we looked at, which is right on top of one of these dark regions, which is cool. So here it is, and you can see the black dust lanes hiding stuff behind. And here's the exact same region from BLAST. This is a cooler picture because it's in three colors, and it's of stuff, dust. So you can see here. So take a look here. This right there, oops. This right here is a bright spot, and it's basically not there. You can barely see anything there in the optical. It's completely enshrouded. But we know that there are actually a couple of O stars in there and B stars. It's a pretty major star-forming cluster, another one there. And then, okay, so what's going on here? Because we're looking at these three colors, 250, 350, and 500 microns near the peak of the blackbody, we can play games with GIMP and make a three-color plot with 250 as red, as blue, and 350 as green, and 500 as red, and then crank the saturation up as high as you can so it actually looks cool, and get this. So what's going on here is red is stuff that's brighter at 500 microns, namely cold stuff, and blue is stuff that's brighter in 250 microns, namely warm stuff. So orange is sort of 10 Kelvin-ish dust, and it's, well, places a star formation is going to happen, but hasn't yet. And blue is places that's already been warmed up by recent or ongoing star formation. So this is cool. Now we can make a census of what's going on, how much dust there is, how much gas there is, where star formation is or isn't happening. So let's take a look at just at this one region here, up close and personal. And you'll notice that it's full of, well, of course, sources. These sources are something like 0.15 parsecs across. Okay, so the nearest star is a parsec, so like a tenth of distance from here to the nearest star is the size of these overdensities. And their masses are something like 10 solar masses-ish. And there's lots of them, and they're cold, like 10 or 12 Kelvin. So that seems like a pretty likely place that stars would be forming, right? Because that you got a cold overdensity of gas, it's going to collapse and form a star, right? Seems like a sensible assumption. We can learn some things about them. Here's a temperature versus numbers of all the sources in the sky, in the map. The blue ones here are just the ones that are heavier than 14 solar masses, just so we can restrict ourselves to the ones which are bright enough that we could see them even if they were very cold. And then the red ones is a histogram of all the blue sources, which are also not seen in the far infrared. Now, they'd be seen in the far infrared if there's a hot guy inside. So we're looking for the cores that look like they don't have any star formation going on them in them. And here they are. They're peaking at around 12 degrees Kelvin, and there's a bunch of them. That's nice. You can go and take a census of them all in this map. And you learn that around 2% of the molecular gas in that cloud is in these cores. And that's something that's been known in other regions. We can estimate, both by measuring it and by looking at the mass of the whole galaxy, the star formation rate in this region. You do some division and wave your hands a bit like an astronomer. I still find that hard to do. And you come up with a time scale that these cores, if these cores become stars, they do so at a time scale of around 4 million years, which is around 10 times slower than one might think it should if they're just cold gas collapsing, right? So that's interesting. Now, we've known for a very, very long time that there's too much gas in galaxies given their star formation rate. Gas does not collapse to form stars nearly as fast as it should at around this discrepancy. And now we're saying actually this discrepancy continues all the way down to the size of cores. So why? A couple ideas. One idea is the gas is turbulent. It's actually moving around. These aren't nice cold clouds of gas. It's actually some random overdensity. Your eye is fooling you. It's not really a gravitationally bound sphere. There's star formation going on inside that's stirring up the gas but not warming it up, the turbulent story. Another story is, there's magnetic fields there, And magnetic fields are complicated and weird, and they keep things from collapsing. And it should be kind of obvious that that should be the case. And then these two camps have their own conferences, and you have the magnetic fields camp conferences, and they don't invite any turbulence people. And you have the turbulence conferences, and they don't invite any magnetic fields people, and they write papers back and forth complaining about how other people are wrong. I'm exaggerating a little bit, but no. Sabina says, no, I'm not exaggerating at all. Yeah, so, apparently I don't get invited to turbulence conferences after this paper. Why not? It's not my fault. So what we're doing is we're trying to see whether or not magnetic fields really have anything to do with star formation by trying to measure the morphology of star formation, of the magnetic fields. So it turns out that dust grains are not perfectly spherical uniform charge objects, but in fact have both an electric dipole moment and a non-sphericity. And they're spinning in space. And if there's magnetic fields, the dust grains will align themselves with magnetic fields as they spin, and then that will cause a net polarization for the radiation coming out, because these things are much smaller than the wavelength light being emitted, so being longer in one direction increases their emissivity slightly. So you get polarized emission from dust grains if the dust grains are in a magnetic field. So then you can go measure the polarization of the dust and look at its morphology and see whether the morphology has anything to do with the morphology of the actual structures. And that might give you some hints as to whether or not magnetic fields are impacting star formation. So here's a picture from some other experiment at very, very small scales of a core. And they claim, oh, look, this hourglass shape is correlated with the morphology, which means that magnetic fields matter. Mm-hmm. That's cool. All right, fine. But this is like one little core. So BLAST, because we're in the submillimeter on a balloon with this amazing detector array, we can do a far better job at polarization measurements than have been done before. So we rebuilt BLAST. We had the drawings, so machine shops know how to make things, even if you've made it before. So that was fun. We got the detectors back. So rebuilt BLAST. Headed down to Antarctica this Christmas and just finished flying it. Here we have BLAST pole about to be launched, and had a lovely flight. One moment of panic, which is fun. Remember that reaction wheel story I told you about? You know, you spin the reaction wheel one way to turn the other. About 6 hours into the flight, the reaction wheel stopped turning, which made pointing harder. But we pushed the gain up and changed the gain of the pivot and futzed around and got it to point again, sort of. Ah! Like dumping 10 amps into the, or 7 amps into the motor, made it turn a bit, so we pointed. All right, so we finished the flight, and we're analyzing it, and hopefully in the next year or so, we'll make polarization maps, and then we'll try and understand whether or not the morphology of the magnetic fields has anything to do with the morphology of the structures, and whether or not magnetic fields have anything to do with regulating star formation. We hope, except it's really complicated and astronomy-ish. All right, but I like physics, right? So we're doing another project, which is more physics-y than astronomy-y. All right, so remember this sort of physicist eye view of the universe, right? You're in the center of the universe, and you look out, and you look far enough away, look far enough back in time. Through the universe is a hot, dense, glowing plasma. This plasma is a cosmic microwave background. Yes? All right, so way back in the ancient days, we flew Boomerang, which measured, made a map of the cosmic microwave background. This is the size of the moon. This is something like 5% of the sky. Determine the constituents of the universe, which is 5% baryons, 30% or whatever, 25% dark matter, and the rest dark energy, Euclidean universe, and finite age. Great. Okay, and then since then, WMAP has come along and retroactively scooped us, and so we're not doing that. What we are doing is trying to measure the polarization of the cosmic microwave background. Now, in 2003, we flew Boomerang again and actually measured the polarization of the CMB. It turns out that this plasma is polarized. Now, why is it polarized? Okay, so the light that's coming from the plasma has been Thomson scattered from around it. And if you have a local quadrupole moment at the spot you're looking at, and these spots are brighter than these spots, then this light, which is polarized this way, will be brighter than this light that's polarized that way. So the polarization of the light gives you a measurement of the net of the local quadrupole moment. Sort of makes sense. That's all right. It doesn't have to. The point is, if you were to actually understand what I just said and think about it really carefully, you would discover that that can only produce what's called E-mode polarization patterns. Either they'll be pointing at bright spots or pointing around dim spots, and some of those. And you can't get anything with helicity or B-modes from that. And with Boomerang 2003, we did measure the sky, we did measure the E-mode polarization, and it was finite, and the B-mode polarization was consistent with zero. Great. Unless one thing happens. Well, you want something that's going to scramble the light coming to you to generate B-modes, like, say, gravitational lensing, right? So imagine you have a bunch of galaxies out there, and they gravitationally lens, and they move your pixels around on you, and then this thing of only E-modes and no B-modes isn't true anymore, because you kind of distorted your image. Great. On small scales, that should happen. It's not been measured, but it ought to happen. On large scales, well, galaxies are small, so you're not going to get that on small scales, on large scales. On large scales, you can get that kind of distortion from gravitational waves. Where do you get gravitational waves from? Well, at these scales, you're only going to get them from inflation. From the very beginning of the universe, during reheating, the idea is these gravitational waves get emitted, distort space-time, mess up the image of the cosmic background. So the curl of the polarization, or the B-modes, can only be produced by gravitational waves from inflation, or systematics, or foregrounds. It's expected from inflation. Now, there's different schools of inflation theories. There's the, ooh, here's a nice, simple potential. And it will produce measurable gravitational waves, like R of about 10%, R being the E-mode to B-mode ratio. Okay. That's cool. Then there's the string theory people who say, no, those potentials are nonsense. It needs to be much, much smaller than that. You should get R of like 10 to the minus 20, which would be unmeasurable. Okay. So it'd be cool if we could measure it, and it might even be cool if we don't measure it. So we're going to try and measure it. The amplitude really is unknown, though. So this is an example of a map. Of the cosmic microwave background with the polarization patterns drawn in. This is a map without B modes, so just the E modes. So if there's no gravitational waves, this is what the polarization pattern would look like to SPIDER, which I'm actually talking about an experiment called SPIDER now. You don't know that. And this is what it looks like with R. So, right? See? It's different. So, you can measure that, right? So, okay, so Engander scale, large scales is L. Large scales, small scales, amplitude. This is the temperature spectrum of the cosmic microwave background. That's what we measured with Boomerang. Down here is the E-mode spectrum. We measured this with Boomerang as well. Down here is an R of 0.1 spectrum of B-modes. And this purple thing is the spectrum from lensing that you expect in B modes. So we're looking for an incredibly small signal, if you think about it in terms of power spectra. We've got E modes in the way. So you're actually just measuring the polarization enough, you have to measure it with really low systematics so you don't accidentally interpret E modes and B modes and make an announcement that you discovered inflation. That's really hard. You want to operate at larger scales. Yeah, that's a pain. So we also have these foregrounds, right? So it turns out that cosmic microwave background is not the only thing on the sky. You've also got synchrotron radiation. This is a spectrum here in frequency now. This is frequency. So up here is short wavelengths and long wavelengths. So you have synchrotron radiation coming down like that. You've got dust radiation, which we're looking at with BLAST over here somewhere, doing this. And then this is the spectrum of the signal we're looking for. So we're going to try and operate in around here, maybe. These are our bands, hoping to be able to subtract out the dust. So we're a lot more sensitive than Planck is. Planck is a satellite trying to do this as well. They measure the whole sky with lower sensitivity. Planck and SPIDER have about the same overall sensitivity. We focus all of our time on 8% of the sky. They look at the whole sky. So it's going to be a pain. We might be nailed by dust. But part of the sky has virtually no dust in it, so maybe we're fine. OK, so here's SPIDER. Bloom-Bourne preliminary, going to map 8% of the sky. We can detect down to R of 0.03. So basically, if the here's a nice potential school of inflation is right, we should be able to detect it. And if the string theory, oh, come on, you can't have delta phi greater than the Planck energy school is right, then we won't. We're going to fly in 2012, and here's the people in the collaboration. OK, so that's SPIDER. And so that's what a bunch of the students here have been working on for their theses. And we're all excited. So, but I want to do something new, since I have 5 minutes, right? So astronomy needs to be cool. And so I want to been thinking about what's the next project, right? And right, Hubble's cool, right? Everybody agree Hubble's cool? Yeah. So the question is, can you do it on a balloon? Yeah? Can we do Hubble on a balloon? That'd be fun. Hubble's going to break, and then, OK. So the answer is maybe, because, well, OK, so flight opportunities. Turns out that people in the past have launched balloons from Australia and let the winds blow them around the world. It takes around 3 weeks to go around once, which is great, except these balloons traditionally are zero-pressure balloons. So what does that mean? OK, let's launch our balloon at dusk when it's nice and calm, and it goes up. And as it goes up, the gas expands. And when it's full, it vents out the bottom because you don't want it to pop. And it comes to an equilibrium and floats along all night, and life is good. And then the sun rises and shines in the balloon and heats up the gas, and the gas expands, and it pops. No, it vents out the bottom because you don't want it to pop. And it flies, floats along all day, and life is good. And then the sun sets, and then the gas unexpands. And it's not full anymore. So if you brought... If you happen to remember to bring along a couple thousand pounds of ballast, you drop it and you're fine. But that's not going to work for very many days. Or you drop down to really low altitudes, unless you get over a storm, and then you drop even lower and eventually fall out of the sky. So you could be lost at sea. So this is really chancy and not really a good option. Optical astronomy needs nighttime, right? But really cool. This, they've been working on this for years, but this winter they finally got it to work. That's what's called a superpressure balloon. In the superpressure balloon story, you launch at dusk, you go up to float, and the gas and as you go up, it eventually gets to its maximum pressure, and you vent out the bottom, and it floats along all day, and the sun rises and shines in the balloon, and the balloon and the gas expands, but the balloon's strong enough that you can keep it pressurized. And they can float along all day and don't vent any gas, and then when the sun sets and it cools, you're still full. So now you can build a balloon that can fly indefinitely. So they're talking about 100-day flights launching from Chile and staying up over the southern hemisphere until you're bored. Should be cool. So maybe we can build something like this on a rope. So the idea is, atmosphere. See, this is what's cool. On the ground, this is the, well, this is sea level, and this is on top of Mauna Kea. This is transmission over across the optical wavelengths. And this is what you get from a balloon. It's really, really great. And the effect of seeing, where atmospheric turbulence messes up your image, is negligible up there because, for one, the convection cells are very large compared to your mirror. And two, it's very, very thin, so your total column is much, much less. And so basically, it's in terms of optical astronomy, it's almost as good as being in space, right up to around 300 nanometers in the near infrared. So the idea is to try and build a balloon-borne telescope that operates in this band here, which is, well, it could be really cool. So what you'd like to do is build this, a 1.5-meter telescope with a 28-degree field of view, 10th arc-second resolution, a gigapixel camera, optical bands. It'll have 380 times the field of view of Hubble, and you can do high resolution wide surveys and lensing, and it would be really, really cool. But this is between $10 and $100 million, depends on who you ask. Let's not do that first. Let's do this first. Now, this is taking leftover parts from Blastpool and buying a 24-inch telescope from the catalog and a CCD camera from the catalog and putting it together and flying it on a balloon. And it'll take cool pictures like 0.2 arc second imaging if it works. And then this, and it can cost like $500,000. And only Hubble will have higher resolution than this, which would be kind of fun. And it might even work. Okay, so that's so this will be really cool later. And do I have time? I do. Do you want to see a picture of a launch, flight, and landing? Yes, you do. Of course you do. Because you're a captive audience. All right, so this is the test flight from BLAST in 2003. This is a bunch of pictures taken by Don Weeb, one of my grad students, and Galen Marsden, who's a grad student out in UBC. So here's the balloon hanging from the launch vehicle, and then you have a cable ladder, and then the parachute to here, and then this is all the balloon up to here. So, and here's the gondola hanging from the launch vehicle, and of course, white duct tape holding it together, because what else would you use? Beginning inflation, there's a semi-trailer here. It's 1.5 semi-trailers full of helium to inflate the balloon. This is about a million cubic meter balloon when it's fully inflated. So inflating it, and now it's ready to launch. So you see the balloon here, and there's a spool that holds it, and the parachute, the balloon comes out to here, and the parachute and stuff. The spool is to hold it in place, and at launch, they pop open the spool, and the balloon will stand up above the launch vehicle. So they've released the spool. You can see the balloon here. This thing called a collar, which keeps the gas up here until it's basically standing up, and then you fire a squib, which drops the collar off. And then it comes down to here, then the parachute and the cable on the launch vehicle. So then this goes up and up, and about now, the driver of the launch vehicle is thinking about how to make sure that the launch vehicle is directly underneath the balloon, so you don't drop it and hit the ground and wreck mayhem. The collar has just come off, and this is right the time you're watching to see whether that's going to land inside your telescope, which it does rarely. It hasn't to us, happily. Okay, so now the driver is driving his launch vehicle to get directly underneath the balloon, and they let it go, and away it goes, off to flight. Now there's a guy in Phoenix for this time who had a telescope on his deck with a camera, and he said, ooh, what's that on the horizon, and took this picture. There's BLAST, and the balloon is completely inflated, unlike the little bubble we saw before. So this is about 100 meters across. End of the flight on a parachute coming down. So NASA has this deal where they say you only can have 33 micro deaths per launch. And the way they calculate that is they measure the square footage of the payload, and they measure the population density of the county. And it's got to be less than 3.3 times 10 to the minus 5. Okay, so and so this is a really... Well, I guess we've had around, what, 8 flights, so. One of our flights in Boomerang, in 1997, the balloon actually got damaged on launch, and it came down near Waco, Texas. And so the balloon, the payload comes down on a parachute, which is bad enough, right? You've got a 2 or 3 ton telescope coming down at 15 miles an hour. That, you know, when it hits your car, it's a bad situation. The balloon, however, well, the balloon is this 100-meter diameter plastic sandwich bag, right? That's just been opened up in 3 millibar, and it starts falling. Actually, like when you disconnect the parachute from the balloon, there's a lacing that goes up the side of the balloon, and it pulls out, and the balloon just becomes open. So it's this giant sheet of plastic. So it's falling. As it falls, it kind of tumbles and vacuum packs itself. And so it hits the ground with sort of the speed, density, safeness of a free-falling minivan. So in 97, a farmer called the police complaining that something really loud had landed in his yard. Our gondola landed in a pond, actually, for the cows to water them, right? And then the parachute dragged it to shore. And we were 3 fish and a frog in the payload. And we had to fly again in 2 weeks, which we did. Except the flight computer actually turned on when it was in the pond. So you couldn't see the individual pins on the chips because of all the corrosion. But in those days, things were big and beefy, and we just cleaned them off and flew it again. All right, on the parachute, on the way down, and it's clearly a really low population density area where it couldn't possibly hit anything. It didn't. And that's how it's supposed to land. Okay, so that's all.